Matt Reschke and Dan Zabrotny are all
That's
on the
correct.
Committee as well.
I'd like to thank all of them for their input, and Dr. Raul, Dr. Eikenberry, and Michelle for helping put together a wonderful agenda. I think we as new trustees learned so much yesterday afternoon in those 2 hours. And I also want to thank all of the faculty who attended and added to our knowledge that we need so much, and we're working very hard to reestablish and continue great relationships with all the university people, not only the faculty, but everyone that works for our university. So it was, I thought, just an excellent meeting. Our topic yesterday was faculty and scholarly work, and we looked at that from five perspectives. The three vice chancellors provided us an overview in three of these five topics, along with a faculty member who gave specific examples of those three topics. Those topics were recruiting and retaining outstanding faculty, programs to advance faculty development, and sabbatical leaves. And we concentrated on sabbatical leaves somewhat, since we'll all be voting on those in just a little while during this meeting today. In addition to those three topics, Vice President Rao gave us a composition of university faculty, and then each of the three students gave an excellent presentation on how their experience with faculty quality has influenced their learning experiences at the University of Illinois. And after all, the input from the students is really why we're all here. So they really added, I think, to our dialogue yesterday. Since we will be voting on upcoming sabbaticals, I've asked two of our presenters from yesterday's meeting to give an abbreviated version of their remarks on that topic this afternoon. First of all, Dr. Harry Berman, who's the Provost and Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs at UIS, is going to give us a definition of what sabbaticals are. And followed by Dr. Berman will be Dr. Kara Fettermeyer. And she is one of the wonderful examples of a young professor who is really going to go places at the University of Illinois. She's actually has her undergrad degree from the Urbana campus. She has her PhD from the University of California at San Diego. And she's recently been teaching Introduction to Cognitive Psychology and Cognitive Psychophysiology. And I'd like to congratulate her especially for winning the 2010 Cognitive Neuroscience Society's Young Investigator Award. And she is going to talk about her recent sabbatical and the value that it's provided not only to her, but to all of us. So Dr. Berman, if you would begin.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm happy to talk with you this afternoon about one of the most significant ways that the university invests in its workforce. And I think we all recognize that successful organizations invest in their people. And sabbaticals are certainly one of the key ways in which we do that. Sabbaticals are used on all three campuses for that purpose. I'm going to touch on three topics. One is what sabbaticals are and what they are not. And the second is a little bit about the eligibility and the process. And the third is a quick overview of what we're talking about in terms of the sabbaticals that are proposed for the upcoming academic year. First of all, in the matter of what sabbaticals are and what they are not, I think it's instructive to think about the word sabbatical itself. And obviously, the root of the word sabbatical is from Sabbath, and that sets up a certain way of thinking about what a sabbatical might be. Now, the first mention of the word Sabbath is in the Hebrew Bible in connection with the creation story. And as we know, God worked very hard for 6 days to create the heavens and the earth. He worked day and night. In fact, he even created day and night along the way. But on the seventh day, God rested. And the Hebrew word for that is Shabbat, the word for rest. And so that can set up a certain sense of what sabbaticals are about. But actually, it's a wrong sense of what sabbaticals are about. And for a more accurate sense, I think we can turn to the second way in which the idea of the Sabbath is used in the Hebrew Bible, and that's in connection with the Sabbath of the land. The idea that the land is cultivated for 6 years, and then in the seventh year, the land is set aside and separated from its customary functions. There's a Hebrew word for that, Shemitah, and that word really means not rest at all. It means separation. Obviously, separation with the idea of rejuvenation. And I'll leave it to my colleague Bob Easter and the people in ACES to describe exactly the biochemistry of that rejuvenation, but we know that it happens. So every sabbatical is a kind of separation from customary duties. And I hope that trustees will understand that the sabbatical really is not a period of rest. It's really a university-determined reassignment of duties. And that brings us to the matter of eligibility and the process for securing a sabbatical. First of all, it's important to understand that it's only our tenure system faculty who are eligible for sabbaticals, the centerpiece of our academic workforce. And a typical kind of pattern would be that in the seventh year, after 6 years of work, a person would be eligible for a sabbatical either for a semester or for a full year. The statutes lay out the precise financial arrangements for different lengths of time, but the typical one would be after 6 years, the person would be eligible for a semester at full pay or for a year at half pay. And as I say, there are other arrangements that are specified. Now, the process, it's not an automatic. It's not a given that a person gets a sabbatical. There has to be a proposal there. And it's worth paying attention to the fact that in this way, university sabbaticals differ from sabbaticals that some farsighted business organizations institute, where there's no particular expectation for a particular project that would occur. Rather, in the university context, there has to be a specific project, and then that proposal is vetted by people at the department level, by the deans, by the vice chancellors for academic affairs, and then ultimately by the board of trustees. So there's a considerable narrowing down that occurs along the way between the people who are eligible for sabbatical and the people whose proposals are coming before you today. So the set of proposals that you're looking at today are for 175 sabbaticals for the upcoming academic year. It sounds like a large number, but just to put it in context, that 175 represents only 5% of the tenure system faculty. So your vote in support of sabbaticals is like saying we're going to make an investment on the career development of 5% of our tenure system faculty for the upcoming academic year. Also, be aware when you consider your vote that every year there's a proportion of these that just don't work out for the individuals involved. Perhaps there was anticipated funding that didn't come through, or some change in life circumstance that prevents the person from taking the sabbatical. And our historic experience is that about 10% of the sabbaticals that are approved are not taken in that year. So ultimately next year we might end up with on the order of 160 sabbaticals across the three campuses. Now another piece of the story for the upcoming academic year is the matter of semester versus year-long sabbaticals. Given the etymological roots, you might think that the sabbaticals are typically for a year. That turns out not to be the case. For the upcoming year, as is often the case, about three-quarters of the sabbaticals will be for one semester only, and the remaining ones for the full year. So in sum, the awarding of sabbaticals is one of the major investments the university makes in maintaining the skills and knowledge of its teaching workforce, the university's most valuable resource. For the coming year, consistent with eligibility criteria and recommendations from colleagues and from administrators, the university seeks approval from the board to award sabbaticals to approximately 5% of the tenure system faculty 3/4 of whom will be on a 1-semester sabbatical assignment. Okay. Now I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Kara Fettermeyer, who will talk about her sabbatical experience and the impact it has had already on her career. Kara?
So this is not the what I did on summer vacation talk. let me give you, I'd like to start with just a little bit of background about my research so that you can understand what I was doing on my sabbatical. My research examines how the brain processes language. And language is obviously a very critical skill. It's one of our primary means of gaining information from our environment. It's central to our social interactions. It's a part of our basic thought processes. And so understandably, language processing deficits are particularly disabling. And it's estimated that between 6 and 8 million people in the United States alone suffer from some form of language impairment. So trying to build an understanding of the psychological and the brain processes involved in language is an important basic research goal that also has clear clinical implications. Now, one thing that many of you may already know about the brain is that it is divided into two halves known as hemispheres. And these two halves of the brain have very similar anatomy, and they have very similar basic physiology, and yet there are important differences in how they function. And with respect to language, one of the long-known facts about language comprehension, but still very poorly understood facts about language comprehension, is that the left hemisphere seems to be specialized in important ways for language. And that's why, for example, strokes that damage the left hemisphere can cause severe language impairments, known as aphasias. While strokes that damage corresponding areas in the right hemisphere also cause problems, but generally actually have little obvious impact on language. So one of the major goals of my research program has been to try to understand what it is about the left hemisphere that makes it better able to process language, and correspondingly, what the right hemisphere is actually capable of doing with language. And this latter point has the long-range implication of trying to understand what functions the right hemisphere might be able to take over when the left hemisphere is, in fact, damaged. In my laboratory here at the Beckman Institute, we do this by measuring brain activity as people read or listen to language using a technique known as EEG, or electroencephalography. Brain signals are inherently electrical in nature, and we can measure that naturally occurring electrical activity by placing sensors non-invasively on people's heads. This provides us with a moment-by-moment view of processing as it unfolds in the brain. And this has really opened an important window into the study of language because we can follow comprehension as it is happening in real time at a level of thousandths of a second. However, it's very difficult with this technique to determine exactly where in the brain the signals we're measuring are coming from at any given point in time. And this puts some limits on our ability to determine, for example, whether a particular process is being carried out by the left hemisphere or the right hemisphere or by both. So this past fall, I spent a semester on sabbatical at the University of California, San Diego. Along with one of my graduate students, who was able to join me for part of the time, I was trained on a different technique known as a magnetoencephalography, or MEG. And this allows you to track many of the same brain processes that we generally measure in my laboratory here, but now to determine not only what they are and when they occur, but now where in the brain they're actually coming from. UCSD is one of very few places in the country that has these facilities. So through a collaboration, we were trained to use the MEG machine. We were able to use it to conduct a complete study looking specifically at now what the right and left hemisphere of the brain are doing during the language processes that we've characterized in our prior work. We're still in the process of analyzing our data, so I can't tell you exactly what we found. But this is a major step forward for our research, and it will inform all the work that we do next. And in addition to the benefits that we get from this to our indeed basic knowledge about language processing in the brain, there are some pragmatic benefits as well. My laboratory is funded by the National Institute on Aging. My grant goes up for renewal next year. And currently, competition for federal funding is extremely intense. Less than 10% of applications are funded. So having this collaboration, this additional expertise, and this kind of data that is very unusual to have can really help make the difference between making that funding cutoff and not. My sabbatical was actually a pretty busy time. Because we're a federally funded lab, we couldn't slow down our research projects here at the university. I also had my full load with respect to mentoring